The Standard Deviations podcast is a weekly production that looks at money, mind, and meaning, all through a psychological lens. Each week, psychologist and New York Times bestselling author Dr. Daniel Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest, experts in everything from finance to literature to wellness.
When was the last time you splurged on something when you knew it probably conflicted with one of your financial goals, like paying down debt or saving for future fun in retirement? Well, if you do this, you're not alone. It's because of present bias, or to use the psychobabble term, hyperbolic discounting. As humans, we have a tendency to let the immediate rewards of the here and now win out over a desired future reality. To learn more, check out the Cash Stash Dash, a planning tool brought to you by the Guardian Network to see just how much your short-term spends might be impacting your longer-term financial goals. Play today by visiting www.livingconfidently.com/play.
Hello and welcome to Standard Deviations. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby, and today I am joined by just our second ever international guest, Maxine Gray, who is responsible for the strategic development of the wealth and investment business at Investec in South Africa. Additionally, she is a philanthropy consultant working with private client charitable foundations in developing their strategic philanthropic direction of achieving sustainable societal upliftment while building their legacy. She is personally one of the most giving and philanthropically minded people I know, and personally oversaw an initiative that gave blankets to 22,000 vulnerable South Africans. Max, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, so you wear many hats. We could have talked about many things today. We could have talked about the world of high finance. We could have talked about philanthropy. But we are here today actually to talk about your role as a UN youth ambassador around the sustainable development goals. So we're going to be talking about socially responsible investing today. So tell us to start off, Max, set the table for us. What are the sustainable development goals and why should the listeners care about them?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, I think for a long time we've understood that the world is in disarray and that they're the highest levels of inequality that there's ever been. But it's almost been too big of a challenge to solve. And what the sustainable development goals do is they provide a transformational agenda with 169 targets that support the 17 global goals that serve as a global footprint to achieving a better and more sustainable future for the people and our planet by 2030. So they tackle social, economic, and environmental challenges. And really, it's about ensuring that we build a collective future and leave no one behind. And I think, I mean, why should we care about this? Well, if we want a world that we want to live in and we want our children to live in and thrive in, you know, we need to start caring about building that world. It's not going to build itself. But there are many personal, professional, you know, business, societal, governmental reasons that we can delve into, I'm sure, a little as we talk.
Now, these were unanimously approved by the member nations of the UN. Is that correct?
Yes, that happened the 25th of September in 2015.
Okay. And how were they arrived at? Just in collaboration between the member nations, got together and sat down and said, what does a better, brighter future for the world look like? How were they constructed?
So, I mean, it was obviously a consultative process, but, you know, before the SDGs came about, there were the Millennial Development Goals, and those were essentially, you know, not necessarily as completely comprehensive as what these 17 SDGs are. So it was, you know, a consultative process between all of the member states to enhance and evolve those Millennial Development Goals into this global framework that each government, society, and business can adopt.
It's pretty incredible that there was such collective buy-in. I know with other sort of green initiatives or other initiatives, it's been very hard to reach consensus. So I think it's a very powerful thing that they had that kind of universal buy-in. So this is, of course, a show where we primarily talk about investing, we talk about business, and certainly where the world of psychology intersects with investing in business. How are these sustainable development goals relevant to the world of investing in business?
So they can be applied in two ways, I suppose, with embedding them within an actual business's strategy, as far as, you know, if you want to build a successful, sustainable business that is going to be around for the foreseeable future, there's been, I suppose, a global shift in understanding. You can't only focus on profit, but you need to focus on your people, profit, and the planet, and really understand that, you know, they need to become integral in terms of your business strategy, the way you process, the way you allocate capital, and the way you make decisions, being conscious of the impact of them. On the actual investing side, the investment case of the SDGs is really the principles for responsible investing. So the PRI is an organization or a body that one as a business, investment business, can subscribe to or sign up to and be a signatory of, which is really a commitment. It's a public commitment towards prioritizing sustainability as a company. And therefore, anyone that really is a signatory of the PRI shows and will actively work towards embedding sustainability into the core of who they are.
Now, there are certainly, it's immediately apparent to me, the sort of personal reasons why this is important. It's immediately important to me, from just like a goodwill perspective, while these things are important. But do you think there are more concrete, tangible business reasons why business people and investors should take these SDGs seriously? Is there like a business case or a financial case to be made for caring about people and the planet?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you go back to the global financial crisis, you start understanding that, you know, this is where sustainability on, you know, policymakers' agenda came into the fore. And principles like ethical or responsible investing at that point was a niche or specialization. And really a responsibility that asset managers have, as stewards of public money, to do the right thing with that money. And for business itself, you know, there are opportunities in terms of unlocking $12 trillion a year worth of opportunities based in the industries that serve around the sustainable development goals, as well as, you know, 50% of which lie in the developing market, as well as countless jobs that can be created as a result. So I do feel that it is the responsible thing to do, to understand that, you know, when we talk about sustainability, it's not only about the planet. It's an all-encompassing theme that includes profit, and it is not an aside to that. And how do you achieve sustainability? Well, you need some sort of blueprint. You need some sort of framework to work towards. And if you align your activities as a company based on the SDGs, understanding that it is the global blueprint, you're essentially having a cohesive workforce or business environment that is actively working towards the same picture. And that's essentially saying, you know, are you going to be part of the solution? Because if you're not, you may cease to exist. So it really is fundamental to not only the profitability of the company and uplifting society, but in ensuring that, particularly from an investment point of view, that if you are the custodian or the steward of public money, that you are acting in the interests of all shareholders, all stakeholders, not only your shareholders.
So there's certainly a camp of people, at least here in the US, where I've had these conversations, where there's a camp of people that would say, you know, the thing to do is to maximize shareholder value. Like a corporation exists for one reason and one reason only. It's to maximize shareholder value. And then if you're philanthropically minded, take your wealth, you know, take the wealth that was created in this very single-minded, shareholder-driven approach and give it to good causes. I think there's a lot of people that think that way. But you make a distinction when you were just speaking. You were making a distinction between sort of stakeholder capitalism and shareholder capitalism. This is something you and I have discussed before, and I don't think it's well understood. At least I'll speak for myself. I didn't understand it well. Can you make the case for stakeholder capitalism versus simple shareholder capitalism, and how might those things coexist?
Absolutely. So, you know, in South Africa, the fiduciary responsibility of and the role of the corporate has been to the company and not to shareholders. Whereas I think in the US, that fiduciary responsibility of the directors of a company is with its shareholders. And shareholders, typically speaking, seek profit. Whereas if it's towards the company, then it can be based on the company's values and the company's goals. I think fortunately, working within Investec and having the understanding that we have always understood that we live within society and not off society. And that has really been the foundation of us always incorporating all stakeholders, understanding that the prosperity of your business is largely rooted in how prosperous your environment is. And so it's not only about how well you can do, not being the best company in the world, but also being the best for the world, because the more the context in which you operate thrives, surely the more growth you can have and the more success that you can have as a business. So it's something that I think is more naturally or more organically embedded into the way that we operate as a company, and therefore is a lot more familiar. But it was raised as the, you know, at the 2020 World Economic Forum for the stakeholders for a cohesive and sustainable world, that was essentially on the agenda. And for the first time, perhaps understanding that from a risk perspective, climate and environmental risks are now moving into the top five risks for businesses. And it's now all of a sudden becoming crucial that it's not only about, you know, giving a hand out when you can, but it's really understanding that if we don't give a hand up and fundamentally change and uplift our societies, that we may not have a business at all. Because if we don't have the environment and the welfare of the people, you know, what's the point of making all this money or trying to aim for more profit?
So I really like this sort of subtle reframing that says, look, there's more people who have something at stake here than the people who own your stock, right? It's actually as we as a business need to do right by the citizenry broadly and all of the stakeholders and not just the people who happen to own our stock. And indeed, I think the shareholder capitalism is sort of short-sighted and can neglect a lot of people who have skin in the game and a lot of potential customers. So the reason I like your explanations of these things is I think we need more people like you in this space who understand both the business practicality of it as well as the social aspect of it. And of course, you know, I'm sitting here coming to you today from the southeastern United States. You're coming to us from South Africa. Both places have a fraught racial history, and both places have great examples of how business used its power for good and to bring about social change. So just quickly, one of my favorite stories about Atlanta, you know, Atlanta's been home to a couple of Nobel Prize winners, but notably Martin Luther King Jr. And when MLK won the Nobel Prize, the city of Atlanta sent out these invitations to sort of all the prominent folks in the area and said, hey, come, we're going to celebrate, you know, our Atlanta's native son winning the Nobel Prize. And no one was coming, like sort of no one RSVP'd because of the racist attitudes of the day. People were not going to come celebrate Martin Luther King's honor. And the head of Coca-Cola, the CEO of Coca-Cola, sent a letter to the prominent businesses in the area and basically said, I know that the city of Atlanta needs Coke, but Coke doesn't need the city of Atlanta. So if you're going to act like this, we're going to pick up and move. And what do you know? Everyone showed up and embraced him warmly. So there's power in this, right? There's power in business being a good corporate citizen, not only to the people that own the stock, but to the community broadly.
Absolutely. I mean, to that point, the private sector is around 75% of global GDP. And you ask yourself, how do you change the bigger picture if 75% of that picture is not in this? And really, you know, if you had to ask me, why would we not achieve the sustainable development goals or the deadline that exists for 2030? You know, there are a few reasons. One of them would really be around, is business adopting this as integral to their strategy? Because this is not a nice to have. This is not an aside. This is something that if we do not all adopt and create a transformative society, surely we will never get there. And to that point, it's actually more a, I suppose, a behavioral thing around understanding responsibility. Like, this is not a problem that exists. Like, climate change, as one example, is not a problem that exists for someone to solve. This is a, you know, we all live on this planet and this is all our climate. And therefore, the problem is all of ours to solve, and we have that collective responsibility. And so what I see happening a lot of the time is everyone wants the change, but no one wants to change. And so to me, it's about understanding, how do we get people to accept this change and to understand that they have an equal role to play? So does the government, yes. So does civil society, yes. But how do you, you know, how do people accept that? So I'm actually going to be a little cheeky here and flip the script on you and say to you, as a behavioral finance, but more just a human behavior expert, how do you think, you know, we can overcome potentially some of our own biases to create this mindset shift and this behavior shift that we need in order to get there?
Okay, that is a little cheeky, turning the tides on me on my own podcast, but I'll allow it. So I think of, when I think about this, I think there's a couple of things we need to do. So I tweeted the other day that, you know, my favorite invention of 2020 has been paper plates, because my family has been using paper plates, I think, more than we ever have in our lives, because we're just so tired. Like, we're just exhausted and we just want to hit the easy button. But of course, there's an environmental impact to that. So one of the things I think from a behavioral standpoint that we need to do is work towards greater salience. So salience is sort of this fancy psychologist term for making something more vivid or more real. Because in a moment where I'm tired and I've had a long day and my kids are fussy, the salience of my tiredness is more vivid, right, than the impact I'm having on the earth.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think we need to make this more vivid and help people understand in more sort of acute, powerful ways just what a failure to act looks like. So there's a great example. There's a great example from the world of retirement savings. You know, we all know that there's, if we're lucky, you know, there's an 80-year-old Daniel out there, there's an 80-year-old Maxine out there, and we need to be saving and preparing for that, you know, future self's retirement. But yet, as I sit here today at 40 years old, that 80-year-old me is not very vivid. It's not very real to me. So what these retirement researchers did is they actually progressed, like using technology, they did age progressions of people's face, and they made, you know, they showed you a picture of what 80-year-old Daniel would look like. And when you saw that picture, you go, oh my gosh, like, this is real, right? This is real. Mm-hmm. I gotta start saving. And people who saw those age progressed faces saved more and saved more often. So we need to make this more vivid and more real, right? I think another thing is that we need to, you kind of already touched on this. In behavioral science, anytime you can leverage an existing human behavior that's already present, it's much more powerful than you trying to sort of thwart a human behavior. So we know that humans are greedy. And so if we can make the case that there is an inextricable link between profit, people and planet, right? If we can show that doing the right thing for the world is also doing the right thing for your pocketbook, I think people will line up, right? I mean, I think people will line up if they say, look, failing to account for ESG type metrics is actually a financial risk to me and it's a threat to my wealth. I think people will be all over this. And then finally, I think what we need to do is we have to teach people and inform them and perhaps even scare them when that's appropriate. But we have to show them the path of breadcrumbs that gets them from that fear to the brighter day, right? And that's why I think these 17 SDGs are so powerful, because the research shows that fear only works when you show a way out. Like, if you just scare someone, but then don't tell them how to avoid the thing they're fearing, they'll write off, they'll write off that thing. So I think we do a good job of saying, look, bad stuff is coming, but that's necessary but not sufficient. We've got to scare people about what the future could look like if we do nothing, but then we've got to give them practical, concrete steps to make to avoid that scary outcome. So
yeah. I mean, I love what you're saying there. I think it sparked off some ideas in terms of, we always talk about technology being this fourth industrial revolution. And what really is exciting is if we could use technology, especially, like virtual reality, to create the future that we don't want and let people experience that, maybe that'll entice them enough to want to get into action and then show them, well, actually there's a tangible plan here. And, that's rooted in these sustainable development goals and the sub targets that exist there. But some people sometimes ask me about practical things. So, these are the global goals. They're on this international scale and it's even hard to absorb them or make them relevant at a business level. So what on earth can I do as an individual? And it goes down to your example of eating, with your kids. And it's really around saying, well, choose one SDG that resonates. It could be your favorite number, 1 to 17. It could be your favorite color of those 17. And then it's about saying, go on a little journey and make it fun. So start unpacking what is that SDG actually about? And what are the underlying targets? And how can we, as a family in our daily activities, just say you choose food security. You can say, the concept of zero hunger. And every time you have a meal, you can use it as an educational tool to enable that kind of conversation. And then say, look at how you can save food, how you cannot waste food. And then you start playing into the interrelatedness of these SDGs, because one thing that's quite beautiful about them is that the sum of the parts is greater than the whole. So it's about saying that if you start working on food security, you actually start impacting climate change. And when you understand that, it almost feels like, oh, hold on, I can achieve a whole lot more just by focusing on one or two, because the interconnectedness and interrelatedness of the impact of achieving them, expands a lot broader than that.
So anytime, I love your point, because anytime you're trying to change a behavior, one of the things that we do is, like, let's say we learn about these 17 SDGs, we get excited, but then I think a lot of times we get overwhelmed because it's like, oh my gosh, 17 things, I got to do 17 things now. So I think when you're trying to elicit behavior change, one of the things you want to do is start small and then build on that. So I'll put you on the spot now. What are a couple of your favorite SDGs, and then talk about that interconnectedness? How, choose one of your favorites and say, how is it that working on thing A leads to an improvement in thing B?
Yeah, so I mean, I could probably choose way more than three, but I suppose focus is important. And it is one of the things most vitally important about making progress with these. So I'm going to make it personal and say, so I'm part of an NGO called Imagination, which focuses on early childhood development in rural communities within South Africa and entrepreneurship. And so I'm going to choose SDG 4, which is education. And really understanding at that early childhood development phase, if we focus on a child's development from when they're young, we essentially are creating a foundation that is so different in terms of like a springboard into the future of opportunity and of possibility within them. And part of that is really understanding, let's teach our children to think and to become entrepreneurs, to be developed in skills, and to believe in themselves and believe in possibilities. And this is where I'll intersect with another SDG, which is SDG 5, which is gender equality, where typically speaking, okay, particularly from like a context where, women have a particular role to play, and it's not a multidimensional role across society, but it's largely, within a household. And understanding if you can empower children at a young age with a good education, teaching them to think, giving them a skill set, and also understanding that, hey, I can be, an engineer, an astronaut, a whatever I want, a portfolio manager. I think it really does start unlocking the foundation of the pipeline of the future that does not have these challenges. So that's one where gender equality and education, where if you start off, you know, you give a child in education, you're giving them a platform for the future. But then if you bring gender into it and you say, well, we're giving it, you know, a boy and a girl the same level of education and the same level of belief that they can be who they want to be, you start understanding that there won't be any like disparate rights or anything that is embedded in a society because you're all on the same playing field, so to speak. And I think lastly, I'll bring in clean and renewable energy, which is SDG 7. And largely because it may sound unrelated, but the whole thing with, you know, and climate is one of the most important ones. Energy is imperative for growth. And so once we've educated these children, and sometimes, you know, through digital means that could require energy and electricity that can come from renewable sources, they need to be able to transition into an economy and into a society that is flourishing. And how can we do that without energy? Especially if the source of our energy is destructive. So it's one of those things that for me is foundational to a lot of the other SDGs. It's about alleviating poverty. It's about growing your, you know, your having decent work and economic growth, and fundamentally can change the shape of the climate. So clean and renewable energy and education are two very foundational SDGs that exist, one particularly focusing on climate and planet and one focusing on people. And I do believe that women have a specifically important role to play in achieving an equitable world, purely just because when you have, you know, a different lens to add to the conversation, perhaps a different natural skill set or natural aptitude for, you know, empathy or whatever it may be, you can come up with different solutions. And what these goals really need is, you know, exponential, ambitious solutions that are different, that are not the same that founded the society of the past. So yeah, I would highlight those three.
So longtime listeners of the show will know that I like to leave listeners with a little bit of homework. So I think the homework for today, if you've been listening to this and you feel moved to try and make an impact on the world, I think is to search out those 17 sustainable development goals and to just pick one that's resonant with you and your life experience and start to work on that, secure in the fact that, as Max just said, that working on one thing is almost invariably going to help in many other areas. So there's this concept in psychology known as the wounded healer, right? Where therapists are shown to be more effective when they're dealing with clients who have been through something that they've been through. So scour those 17 SDGs. Maybe there's been a time in your life when you were hungry. Maybe you've been discriminated against on the basis of gender in the workplace. Whatever it is, find out that thing that's personally resonant with your experience. Start to work on it. Start to chip away and know that they all build and that they're all interconnected. So Max, when you told me about these SDGs and I began to research them, one of the things that struck me was how quick the timeline was. You know, these were set forth in, I believe you said, the fall of 2015, fall in the Northern Hemisphere. So, you know, the fall of 2015. They're slated to sort of wrap up by 2030. So we're already a third of the way there. How are we doing? You know, 33% of the way there. How are we doing and what remains to be done?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, I think it's one of those things that has certainly been a bit of a bell curve in that I think the understanding, the adoption, the level of work done around measuring and tracking impact, all of those things, the, you know, how do we translate these into business? What does it mean at a local government level? That groundwork is essentially what takes the longest. And I think that is what has happened over the last 5 years. And I think there has been an acceptance and an acceleration of acceptance of understanding that we are not going to get there unless we really, you know, ramp up. So, you know, it's very hard to say, okay, well, where are, you know, are we 25% of where we want to get to? Because a lot of the effort and a lot of the foundation work can lead to exponential growth as far as the impact or achieving that end goal is concerned. But, you know, a lot of these things are really not new. So a lot of stuff, it's almost just a new way of looking at them. It's a more global footprint that is agreed. They're not necessarily new, but I think what is new and has potentially been exacerbated by COVID in a positive way is the acceptance of these things being very real to affecting our daily lives. So I would say that we needed, you know, much more business adoption of these things. We needed companies to start making radical moves, like, you know, not holding shares or voting for companies where there are no female directors on a board or anything that's really bold. And we have started seeing that coming out. And now it's almost like this domino effect where every day I just see a headline of something, you know, rooted in either ESG principles, sustainability in general, gender diversity, whatever it may be. But yeah, I mean, I think we've got a long way to go. I don't think we are where we should be at this point in time. I certainly don't think we're 33% of the way of achieving them. Perhaps in preparing to achieve them, we are as far as we should be. But, you know, COVID has been something that has had a bilateral effect where in one aspect, you know, funds have been diverted from a lot of the programs or initiatives to act that are actively going to help in achieving these things and have been reallocated towards those that are most affected by COVID. And then on the other side, you've had this very real realization where, hold on, like, this is not me sitting in South Africa, you know, going through something. Like, this is the whole world and this is affecting all of us. And, you know, this is forcing me to stay at home, not see my friends, not go to the office, not do and live my life the way that I normally would have. And that's kind of making it, I think, a lot more real, that this is not an existential problem that is going to be solved, but this is something that is actually personal because it's going to affect my life personally. And we've had climate activists for a long time, or at least the last couple of years, really beating the climate drum hard, which is essentially the E. And then you have the S and the G, which is really around your social and governance principles that speak to, you know, the way you treat your employees, your society, the people around you. And that's what COVID has essentially done, is it's heightened the profile of that. So I think in general, there has been an acceleration, which is much needed. So, I mean, I am an optimist by nature. And so I'd be willing to say, even though we're not where we potentially would have liked to be, I think that we can still get there. We just need that ambition and that acceptance of responsibility that each and every one of us has a role to play.
You know, I like how you talked about that bifurcation. It's something that I've seen as well. On the one hand, you started out this conversation by talking about wealth inequality, and that has been heightened by COVID. We know that at least in the U.S., the people who could least afford to lose their jobs have been the ones that were most likely to. You know, white-collar workers, upper-middle-class workers have been largely unimpacted by this, but people in the lower socioeconomic strata have been the most impacted by this. And so we know that, you know, this has in some very real ways heightened what was already a huge problem of wealth inequality. But what I think it has done to the upside, and, you know, speaking to your optimism, it's true that the biggest problems we face can only be solved as a collective, can only be solved as the entire world working on these things, right? One country can't carry climate activism by itself, because if one country tries and the rest don't care, then where are we, right? And so even at a time where I think there is heightened isolationism and heightened nationalism at various places across the globe, I think one silver lining with COVID is that, you know, not since World War II have we been so focused as a human family on trying to solve one single problem together. And so I think that that's what it takes going forward, is that same type of collectivism, that same type of unity. And so hopefully we can get together on these 17 SDGs the same way that we have to try and combat COVID.
Yeah, I love that point. I think, you know, the way I see it is that all of these things that are really being exposed were fractures that already existed. But then what happened was COVID came and just broke that all apart. And so it made them that much more visible and that much more damaging and severe. But I mean, like we know, that's how the light gets in, right? So if it's not broken, then the light can't get in. And so I kind of see it in that light, that it's perhaps fast forwarded where we would have eventually got to anyway, had we continued on the trajectory that we were living, and perhaps given us then, or almost bought us time to rewrite that script and say, well, you know, maybe now that we can actually see the future that we were, the way in which we were living, this was the future it was going to create, just over a longer period of time, that's been brought forward. And so perhaps it gives us the upper hand in saying, well, if this is now the future's now. So we now need to act and we now need to change. And we now need to do things to fundamentally rewrite that so that the future looks different.
Absolutely. So Max, you've given us a ton to think about today, and I'm hopeful that everyone will take, you know, this challenge to seek out these 17 sustainable development goals, find the one that's most personally resonant and to begin to chip away at it. But in closing, we like to do something called free association. So this is like what a shrink does. Throw out a word or a phrase, and you just tell me, without overthinking it, just tell me the first thing that comes to your mind. You in?
Yeah, sure, go for it.
I'm not totally convinced, but we're going to go for it. So what is the greatest misconception about South Africa?
Oh, wow, I think there's so many. I'd perhaps say, you know, the most comical one to me is that I'm sitting, you know, with a lion next to me right now in a tree recording this. But I'd say for real, it's that people don't necessarily see the diversity that exists here. And that's diversity in terms of people, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of landscape, in terms of opportunity, in terms of spirit. And I think it's actually what makes us pretty unique and pretty special. So I would say, you know, it's perhaps painted as just with the poverty brush, and it is an incredibly important like piece of our society. It's a huge thing that we need to be very conscious of and work towards alleviating. But that's not the whole picture. There's a lot more to it that I don't think people see or know exists.
More than poverty and lions, there's a diversity of humanity and a diversity of spirit. Beautiful, beautifully said. What's the best thing about South Africa?
Okay, so I mean, because I could never say one thing, I'm going to say firstly the weather. It is basically the sun shining at all times, and I'm a sun child. So to me, if the sun shines, I'm happy. And so 90% of the time, or at least 95% of the time, that's the case. I'd say second is probably the people. And we have this word called Ubuntu, which means I am because you are. And it really is around a collective spirit of generosity, of openness, of friendliness. And, you know, just there's something about a South African community that I don't think you can replicate anywhere in the world.
Awesome. So last question. What is an experience you've had in South Africa that you couldn't have had anywhere else in the world?
Wow, that's a tough one.
Being with a lion, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I don't know, right? So you could go in Africa. Like that's okay. Maybe that's also a misconception that like South Africa and Africa are like one thing. There's like one thing called Africa. And actually, no, there's like many countries in Africa, all with their own beauty to share. But so I'd say, you know, that you could have an experience like that probably in quite a few African countries. I think an experience that you could only have in South Africa, it's maybe like just finding humor in chaos. You know, we have this thing here called load shedding, which essentially, because we have the infrastructure, power infrastructure issues, we have these scheduled blackouts that happen and have been happening for like 7 years or more than that perhaps. And you know, people kind of like get the candles ready and get the food done and do what they got to do, make it romantic, you know, have a good time, and just I think really create humor and make something out of nothing. I think that's a it's a pretty unique South African quality. And so it's not like an experience per se, but rather a thematic one.
Well, I have been lucky enough to meet and interact with quite a few different South African clients this year. One of the cool things for me is that COVID has kind of broadened my world. Like I've gotten to work with clients that I perhaps wouldn't have historically because Zoom is borderless. And so I can testify that every South African I've met has really embodied the sort of spirit that you talk about and has a great attitude and has really become adept at finding silver linings and finding humor and positivity in the midst of the chaos that is 2020. So Max, if people want to learn more about you, if they want to learn more about your work, where can they read your writing? Where can they follow your ideas online?
So I think the best place for that would be via LinkedIn. So my profile is just Maxine Gray, and you'll identify me with a lot of how you introduced me in terms of my role at work and what I do. I also on there share anything that I have written. I share pieces from the United Nations Global Compact, which is essentially an arm of the United Nations focusing on business. A lot of stuff that comes out that is interesting and aligned to this theme of work. So yeah, I would say my LinkedIn profile would definitely be the best place.
Okay. Maxine, thank you so much for being here. You were a wonderful guest.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by the Guardian Life Insurance Company of America, Guardian, and its affiliates, subsidiaries, employees, and agents, including Park Avenue Securities and the Guardian Network. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information participants consider reliable, and Dr. Crosby and Guardian are not responsible for the consequences of any decisions or actions taken because of the information provided. Guardian copyright is a registered trademark of the Guardian Life Insurance Company of America. All materials are subject to United States copyright laws. Copyright 2020 Guardian. 2020-109350, expiration 09/22.